Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Jane Donahue. Today we bring you to the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations in Rockland, Maine. Farah Pandith, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of How We Win, argues that soft power may be the best strategy for responding to hate and explains how diplomacy, cultural exchange, and foreign aid are crucial for combating violent extremism. This talk was recorded live on August 11, 2025, and was moderated by Midcoast Forum Board President George Look.
So good afternoon. Welcome to the 485th meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. Since its founding more than 40 years ago, the forum has been meeting monthly to hear an invited speaker on a topic central to U.S. foreign policy. At today's meeting, we will be pleased to have Ms. Farah Pandith here to speak on How We Win, the Threat from Hate and the Power of Compassion. Farah Pandith is a foreign policy strategist and former diplomat. She is currently a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and an adjunct professor at Georgetown University. She is a world-leading expert and pioneer in countering violent extremism and author of the book, How We Win, How Cutting-Edge Entrepreneurs, Political Visionaries, Enlightened Business Leaders, and Social Media Mavens Can Defeat the Extremist Threat. She is a frequent media commentator and public speaker, and has written for publications including The Economist, The Washington Post, and The New York Times. Farah served as a political appointee under three presidents, most recently as the first ever special representative to Muslim communities, serving both Secretaries Clinton and Kerry. She has served in various senior roles on the National Security Council, at the U.S. Department of State, and at the U.S. Agency for International Development. She was appointed to the Homeland Security's Advisory Council, chairing its Countering Violent Extremism Task Force. She serves on leadership or advisory boards of organizations including We Are Family Foundation, America Abroad Media, the Asian American Foundation, USC Center on Public Diplomacy, and the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. Over the last decade, she has been a senior fellow at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School, a senior advisor with the Anti-Defamation League, and a senior advisor at the Milken Center for Advanced American Dream. In 2020, the Muhammad Ali Center named Farah the first ever Muhammad Ali Global Peace Laureate for her proven track record of and commitment to promoting humanitarian values. She is a creator and catalyst for the Muhammad Ali Index on Compassion. Farah received a bachelor's degree from Smith College and a master's in law and diplomacy from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. Farah was born in India and raised in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Farah, welcome to the Midcoast Forum.
He read the very long bio. I want to thank you so much for that very kind introduction, George, and for the invitation to speak with you today. I'm delighted to be back in New England. As you heard, I grew up in Massachusetts, and thus being along this gorgeous coastline makes me really happy. Thank you for this gift and for your interest in doing something a bit more serious on this beautiful, perfect summer August day. We find ourselves at a critical juncture in American history, a moment when the very foundations of our global leadership are being tested, not just by external adversaries, but by the divisions in our own society. Here at home, we are contending with a rising tide of hate that seeks to fracture our national unity from within. Abroad, we face a world of complex threats and fierce competition from rivals who seek to displace American leadership. These two fronts are not separate, quite the opposite, in fact. They are deeply, intrinsically linked, and I want to spend the next half an hour or so discussing how and why that link is so important to understand today. Let me begin with an uncomfortable truth. We are living through what can only be described as an epidemic of hate. The Southern Poverty Law Center's 2024 Year in Hate and Extremism report documented a staggering 1,371 hate and anti-government extremist groups operating in the United States last year. These groups are not all well organized, and they certainly aren't all working in concert, but they no longer represent a fringe element either. The us versus them mentality that these groups espouse is tearing at our social fabric. The political divide that has grown so vast that, according to the Pew Research Center, 8 in 10 US adults now believe that voters from the two major parties cannot even agree on basic facts. This isn't just a disagreement over policy. It's a breakdown in shared reality, one that leads to what scholars call effective polarization, where we increasingly view those in the other political party as not just wrong, but as close-minded, dishonest, and immoral. This sense of division is a painful daily reality for millions. The Asian American Foundation's 2024 Status Index reveals a profound sense of dislocation. Only 38% of Asian Americans feel that they truly belong in American society. This feeling is a symptom of a deeper illness, and this data point is but a snapshot of a much larger phenomenon. The latest FBI data on hate crimes paints a grim picture, showing a rise of reported incidents targeting Black Americans, LGBTQ+ individuals, and religious minorities. Worryingly, this us versus them thinking is becoming deeply ingrained in our next generation. Recent research shows that young people are more likely to view political opponents not just as people with different ideas, but as a fundamental threat to the nation's well-being. We are teaching our children to see half the country as the other. What's fueling this fire? The sources are interconnected. Political leadership and culture that legitimizes and normalizes division, social media algorithms that amplify hatred and for profit, and communication systems that reward outrage over understanding. Events of the day both showcase the explosive potential of latent hatreds and worsen the problem. For example, in a September 2024 analysis, the Soufan Group detailed how the Israel-Hamas war has become a powerful tool for extremists, leading to a sickening rise in both anti-Semitic and anti-Muslim hate here in the West, manipulated by state actors who use disinformation to deepen the societal fissures. The Institute for Strategic Dialogue has tracked a terrifying explosion of anti-Semitic content online since October 7th attacks. Their research shows that online platforms like Telegram, conspiracy theories blaming Jewish people for war, promoting Holocaust denial, and reviving ancient blood libels have surged in the past 22 months. These aren't just words on a screen. They translate into real-world violence and intimidation. These trends have led to a chilling effect on open dialogue and intensified fears of marginalization among Americans who are both Jewish and Muslim. We know from the 9/11 attacks that the ripple effects in our neighborhoods are real. I hope that during the Q&A portion of today, you will ask me about my work post 9/11 in talking with Muslim communities, but it is vital that we understand that the post 9/11 world also produced violence and hate against Hindus and Sikhs and others across our nation. I do not need to tell this audience that even if you are not any of these minority groups, this information should alarm you as a human being first and foremost, and it matters to America's bottom line. The combination of 9/11 and the attacks on 10/7 are critical to understand because these domestic incidents reverberate in our foreign policy, complicate U.S. diplomacy, and strain relationships with our allies in Europe and developing nations, and often damage America's reputation as a fair broker. In a 2024 Arab Barometer survey, favorable views of the United States fell by 12 points across several Arab nations. This past spring, an Ipsos poll, the findings were sobering, as it found that the belief in the U.S. as a force for good falls. Specifically, the proportion saying America will have an overall positive influence in the world affairs has fallen in 26 out of 29 countries over the last 6 months. The impact of this rising hate is corrosive. It harms individuals' physical and mental health. It erodes empathy and poisons our communities by destroying social trust. A society that cannot trust itself cannot solve its problems. The crisis of confidence could not come at a more perilous time. Post-Cold War optimism has given way to a stark reality of renewed great power competition. Trust between nations is eroding. Tensions are simmering in critical hotspots. All of this is made worse by what the American Academy of Diplomacy calls the fire hose of falsehoods that our adversaries are wielding. Revisionist powers like China and Russia need not present a new theory of the case for international order. Their strategy is to dislodge the U.S. from its place of primacy and can rely largely on sowing confusion in the information environment to weaken American leadership. Navigating this messy, multipolar world requires more than just the blunt instruments of military might or economic coercion. It demands credibility and the ability to persuade and to build coalitions. This is precisely where our internal divisions become a critical national security threat. A nation that cannot agree on basic facts at home cannot project a coherent vision to the world. To protect American interests in this volatile environment, we must relearn how to wield our most subtle yet most powerful asset, our soft power. To understand why this matters so profoundly for American foreign policy, we must return to the concept that the late Joseph Nye introduced to the world 3 decades ago, soft power. Soft power, as Dr. Nye defined it, is, quote, the ability to affect others to obtain the outcomes one wants through attraction and persuasion rather than coercion or payment, unquote. This is not merely an academic concept. It is the secret weapon that has underpinned American global leadership since 1945. A country's soft power rests on its resources of culture, values, and policies. When people around the world choose to learn English, when they line up to see American movies, when they send their children to American universities, when they look to American institutions as models for their own democracies, that is soft power in action. As Nye himself has observed, quote, power does not lie in brute strength, but in the ability to shape the preferences of others, unquote. This insight revolutionized our understanding of international relations. Military might can compel behavior. Economic leverage can incentivize. But only soft power can inspire others to want what we want, to share our values, to see the world as we see it, to believe that their interests align with ours. American soft power is not theoretical. It has helped deliver concrete strategic victories. The most dramatic example is the Cold War, which we won through not through military conquest, but through attraction. This is a very simplistic, bare-bones summary, but you understand the core message. People behind the Iron Curtain yearned for American music, American movies, and most critically, American freedoms. They listened to the voice of America. They read smuggled American books. They dreamed of American opportunities. They wanted to be like us. The Marshall Plan exemplified soft power in action. Yes, it provided economic assistance, but more importantly, it demonstrated American generosity, American vision, and American commitment to helping others rebuild, rather than simply dominating them. Europeans didn't just receive American aid, they embraced American values. The Camp David Accords represented another triumph of soft power. President Carter brought together Egypt's Anwar Sadat and Israel's Menachem Begin not through threats and bribes, but through patient diplomacy, personal relationships, and an appeal to shared hopes and their people's futures. The agreement held not because it was imposed, but because it was embraced. More recently, the expansion of NATO eastward after the Cold War succeeded because Eastern Europe nations genuinely wanted to join the Western alliance. They saw in NATO and the EU not just security guarantees, but a pathway to prosperity, democracy, and individual freedoms that they had denied under the Soviet domination. In 2007, then Secretary of Defense Robert Gates stood at Kansas State University and gave a stark warning. He said, "I am here to make the case for strengthening our capacity to use soft power and for better integrating it with hard power." He argued that the civilian instruments of national security, diplomacy, strategic communication, foreign assistance, civic action, were dangerously underfunded. He knew that a soldier with a rifle cannot build a school, a drone strike cannot win the ideological argument, and an aircraft carrier cannot generate the goodwill that fosters lasting peace. Secretary Gates knew what history has repeatedly shown us. American soft power gets results. After World War II, it was the Marshall Plan, not an accompanying army, that rebuilt Western Europe into a bulwark of its strong democratic allies. During the Cold War, the broadcast of Radio Free Europe did as much to undermine the Soviet Union as any weapons system by showing millions more an attractive way of life. And more recently, PEPFAR, or the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, has saved over 25 million lives, building a reservoir of goodwill across Africa and demonstrating American compassion and competence at a breathtaking scale. Soft power comes in other forms too. In the work that I did in both the Bush and Obama administrations to engage with Muslim youth around the world in post 9/11, it is a form of soft power. The directive from the top was clear. How can we find ways of building bridges of understanding, find opportunities to partner, and advance initiatives we all care about, build networks, and form coalitions? Fighting the ideology of a terrorist group like Al-Qaeda or ISIS, or indeed violent extremist neo-Nazi groups, is soft power. I will give you a specific example. The United States created the first of its kind network of former extremists, former FARC, former Al-Qaeda, former neo-Nazis, and so on. We knew that we could use the power of the US government to be the convener and the facilitator. These former extremists were powerful voices to help others stop from joining extremist groups. This is soft power. The decision to launch and sustain these big and small programs were powerful signals to vast corners of the world about what the United States wanted to achieve, both for itself and for the collective good, from its position of strength and at times hegemony. The revocation of these programs, especially the life-saving medical programs like PEPFAR, is perhaps sending an even stronger signal. Now, while we struggle with internal divisions. Our strategic competitors are investing heavily in their own soft power capabilities. China made a, quote, big bet on soft power, as the Council on Foreign Relations documented, investing billions in cultural institutions, educational exchanges, and technological showcases. The results are troubling. Pew Research 2023 data shows that younger adults aged 18 to 39 are more likely than those 40 years or older to offer positive ratings of China's entertainment, technological achievements, and universities in roughly half of the countries surveyed. The median of 62% across eight countries say that Chinese technology is well made, and nearly half believe Chinese technological products protect personal data. This represents a fundamental shift in global perceptions. For decades, American technology, American universities, American entertainment set the global standard. Now, we are losing that advantage not because our products have declined in quality, but because our image has been tarnished by our internal divisions and our retreat from global leadership. Iran, too, has developed sophisticated soft power strategies, extending influence throughout the Middle East, throughout using cultural and religious networks. Even Russia, despite its cruder approach, has announced the creation of a Russian equivalent to the U.S. Agency for International Development as we are looking at our closing down of that current agency. The irony is profound. As America retreats from soft power production, authoritarian regimes are embracing it, understanding what we seem to have forgotten, that the ability to shape hearts and minds is often more decisive than the ability to threaten or bribe. Former secretaries of state and defense have long understood this connection. Secretary of State Colin Powell once remarked, quote, "No foreign policy can be sustained in the United States of America without the informed consent of the American people." But consent requires unity, and unity requires a shared sense of purpose and values. Secretary of Defense James Mattis put it even more bluntly. He said, "If you don't fund the State Department fully, then I need to buy more ammunition ultimately." This wasn't hyperbole, it was strategic realism. Diplomacy, cultural exchange, development aid, and public diplomacy are not luxuries. They are force multipliers that make military action less necessary, and when it is necessary, more effective. As Richard Fontaine and Stephen Hadley noted in Foreign Policy magazine, "The United States thrives in a stable international environment and amid substantial domestic unity. Washington possesses everything necessary to succeed, even in a tumultuous world, so long as it remains politically united enough to marshal these advantages in a common purpose." This is the essence of soft power as national security. Our ability to lead internationally depends fundamentally on our cohesion at home. And here at home, there's work to be done by non-government organizations to help understand the problem and create solutions. Consider the Muhammad Ali Center's landmark Index on Compassion, which measures society's capacity for empathy and mutual understanding. This is not merely a feel-good metric. It is an indicator of national strength. Societies with higher level of social trust and compassion are more resilient, more innovative, and more attractive to partners. They are also more effective at building coalitions necessary to address global challenges. The index is a critical effort, and it can help our cities and towns and neighborhoods to become more compassionate. We must surge efforts like this and focus and focus and focus. What do we need to do to build more compassion, strengthen societal bonds, learn to disagree well? Just as this global competition intensifies, we face new challenges. And tragically, they are engaging in a unilateral disarmament of our own soft power arsenal. I believe the systematic dismantling of America's soft power infrastructure represents what can only be called strategic self-sabotage. The shutdown of the Voice of America, the elimination of the U.S. Agency for International Development, and the dramatic cuts in foreign aid, and a rhetorical posture that expresses resentment towards global responsibilities and moral commitments. It is a shame. The folly of the current approach is apparent for geopolitical considerations that have existed for decades, but it is equally as clear for elements that are emerging and rapidly developing as we speak. The nation that leads in artificial intelligence, for example, will have a tremendous advantage in shaping global norms. In 2025, China surpassed the United States both total AI research publications and patent applications, according to Stanford's AI Index. The OECD reports that in 2023, China's government sector AI R&D was 60% higher than that of the United States. Meanwhile, we lack a coherent national AI strategy, and ongoing political dysfunction has stalled bipartisan legislation on ethical AI development, digital diplomacy, and global norm setting. This strategic leadership vacuum has consequences. When we fail to shape the global norms around AI, privacy, fairness, transparency, we cede the influence to our adversaries. If American soft power is about inspiring and attracting others through example, then leadership in AI is not optional. It's a prerequisite for maintaining our cultural, intellectual, and moral influence in the digital age. The innovation of Silicon Valley, the ubiquity of American technologies, and the global reach of Hollywood are potent forms of soft power. They make America a global magnet for talent and a symbol of opportunity. But let me be clear. Americans themselves, in our daily lives, in how we treat the other, in what we say online and offline, in the character of our actions and the discourse, influence the world too. That magnetism, however, is changing. Global investors are now forced to more heavily consider political risk for the United States, a calculation once reserved for volatile emerging markets. This instability deters investment. It threatens our world-class university system, which in 2024 contributed nearly $44 billion to our economy from international students alone. As our domestic climate becomes more hostile, top-tier global talent is now increasingly looking to universities in Canada and Europe and Asia. We are telling the world's best and brightest to take their talents, their innovations, and their economic contributions elsewhere. More dangerously, this approach leads to a regression in American strategic thinking. By defending the agencies tasked with the, quote, soft elements of power, we force ourselves to rely even more heavily on the military. We are cashing in our leverage for short-term gains, diminishing our ability to build coalitions and lead with anything other than force. I'm not making the case that we do not need hard power or that we should not fund it. I am making the point that soft power is limitless. Its creativity and innovation only stops when we put on the brakes. There are incredible opportunities to persuade through attraction that cost pennies on the dollar. Why wouldn't we demand more soft power initiatives, not less? As I learned during my years developing countering violent extremist strategies, it is all about soft power and the grassroots. You cannot defeat the ideology with an ideology. You defeat it with something better, something more compelling, something that speaks to people's deepest needs for belonging, purpose, and hope. This is where America's greatest strength lies, not in Washington, but in our communities. With local leaders that build bridges across divides, when entrepreneurs create opportunities for young people, when educators inspire students to see beyond their immediate circumstances, when artists and creators tell stories that celebrate our common humanity, that is soft power in its most authentic and effective form. The power of compassion we show for others, at the local community mirrors the approach we have modeled in our foreign policy since 1945. Yet, we have failed to always play by the same rules. And yes, we have fallen short of the standards to which we hold others. But we have also deliberately foregone benefits that our power could have yielded, especially in moments like the 1990s, when our relative power was very significant. We chose reconstruction over exploitation after World War II, alliance building over empire building during the Cold War, integration over isolation as globalization accelerated. Recently, Chloe Hadavas asked in Foreign Policy magazine, "Is American soft power finished?" The answer depends on the choices we make today. Foreign Policy magazine states it like this: "The administration's actions are sacrificing an exponential source of American strength, ironically in the name of efficiency, despite soft power's low price tag compared to its vast impact. We are trading away our greatest strategic advantage for the illusion of savings." But this trajectory is not inevitable. Soft power can be rebuilt. Relationships can be restored. Trust can be renewed. The world still looks to America for leadership, not because they fear us, but because they still believe, despite everything, that America at its best represents something worth following. The tools are still at our disposal. Our universities remain the finest. Our technology companies are still setting global standards. Our popular culture still captures global imagination. Our ideals of freedom and opportunity still inspire people everywhere. The question is whether we will use the tools wisely or squander them carelessly. In 1961, John F. Kennedy spoke of America as a city upon a hill, watched by the world. That metaphor endures because it captures something essential about American power. It is most effective when it is aspirational rather than coercive, when it lights the way forward rather than demanding submission. The hate that divides us today is real, but it is not permanent. The compassion that built our greatest achievements is equally real, and it is renewable. The choice between these two impulses, between the America that inspires and the America that intimidates, will determine not just our domestic future, but our global destiny. This brings me back to where I began. The state of our new union is inseparable from our standing in the world. A house divided cannot stand. The power of compassion that we show to each other at a local level is the very same power on which we have modeled our most successful foreign policy. The threats of today merit not just a whole of government approach, but a whole of society approach. It demands a soft power surge. The surge must include empowering all State Department's decades long worth of lessons learned, revitalizing and fully funding the U.S. Agency for International Development, the Peace Corps, and our array of educational and cultural exchanges like the Fulbright Program, which will attract the next generation of global leaders. It means leveraging the power of our private sector, our NGOs, and our universities, and our cultural icons in a coordinated national strategy. But most importantly, a successful soft power strategy requires a compelling product to sell. In 1945, American leadership has been at its strongest when it had been about more than just our own interests. Yes, we failed to always live up to our ideals, but at our best, John Eikenberry wrote, when our relative power was at its absolute peak, we chose to strengthen institutions, to bind ourselves by a system of rules. To project a coherent message abroad, we must first agree on our own story. We must forge a unifying national narrative grounded in our core values: democracy, respect, innovation, and opportunity. We will not win by building higher walls, but by building stronger bridges. Not by shouting louder, but by listening better. The antidote to hate is not more hate, it is compassion. The antidote to division is not more division, it is unity. And the key to American strength in the 21st century lies not in our capacity to dominate, but in our capacity to inspire. It starts here, in our communities, in our willingness to see the humanity in those with whom we disagree. We can heal our division if we can heal our divisions at home. There is no challenge we cannot meet abroad. Thank you.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's show is a presentation of an address to the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations by Farah Pandith, author of How We Win, How Cutting-Edge Entrepreneurs, Political Visionaries, Enlightened Business Leaders, and Social Media Mavens Can Defeat the Extremist Threat. Stay with us for a Q&A led by Board President George Look.
I always, while they're collecting questions from the audience, I take the opportunity to ask the first question myself. And I wonder if you could speak a little bit more about the role of non-governmental soft power efforts and their ability to project the U.S. image, and whether all that has to be coordinated by the government or whether there's more we can do in this time when we're not really getting much government cooperation.
Right. So the most effective strategies at the grassroots are when, in my view, we have a balance between things that are brought to you by the U.S. government and things that are inspired by the U.S. government, so that you don't always have to see the American flag on things. Even though we have cut the budgets on soft power in the United States, non-government organizations play a really critical role. They play a role because the values that we want to inspire in communities around the world obviously matter. And I talked in my speech about the role of the US government that I used as the convener and the facilitator, and in fact, the intellectual power with the idea that I saw on the ground. What I was doing when I was doing work fighting the ideology of extremism, for example, I didn't always want to do this with an American flag behind me. I was always transparent that the things that I was doing, I was gathering people together. I was a US government official, but I could use my power to convene, to bring people together to say, you need to meet this person, you need to meet this person, how can you work together? Do you want trainings? Do you want whatever they might need? So the US government can do things like that with NGOs on the ground, with individuals on the ground, but they can also do things through our embassies that are, of course, brought to you by the US government. So the kinds of programs that are put on, the kinds of cultural heritage, you know, you talked about the Silk Road group that's going to come speak with you. Convenings of music, musicians and artists and others, we as the US government do all the time in our embassies around the world. We also have our ear to the ground to hear what's actually needed and what people are asking about in terms of learning about more about the United States and things that they want to do. So we can partner with NGOs that are actually doing this. So in essence, it's a two-pronged answer. One is there's work that the US government does through our public diplomacy offices, through the work that we do in a non-kinetic way, but it's also the inspiring work that we can do by simply convening without the US government flag behind us necessarily to activate a ripple effect in communities all over the world. It's critical. I would like to say one more thing about that. I very specifically talked about nonprofits because I'm looking at 200 people in the audience today. All of you have had incredible careers. Your knowledge matters to what's happening right now. The fact that you're here today learning about this is one step. I know that there are things that you can do in your churches, in your synagogues, in your local, you know, yacht club, in your whatever you're doing that can make a difference to the way in people think about the other. And I would say to you, don't forget those nano interventions. This one-on-one stuff, you may think, how can it make a difference? It can make a difference. And I have seen that firsthand. So it's a long way of answering your question, but you have power too, is what basically I'm saying to you.
Someone wants to ask, is there anyone in the current administration speaking up for more investment in soft power?
I have not seen anyone.
And then another question is, do you see either political party using soft power, building coalitions, et cetera, and thus giving a sense of hope for breaking the current polarization? Or are we drifting?
I don't think the responsibility is only on both political parties. As I've talked about, I think it's all of us that make up America to demand that our political leaders and our cultural leaders and our influencers and everything else reflect the values that we think are important. Neither of the parties are doing the kind of advanced, aggressive bridge building that they could. It is not as though we do not have solutions that are available right now. If I told you that the aliens were attacking and everybody in this room who has different opinions had to get together and figure out a way to stop the aliens, I bet you could figure out a way to do this, right? It is the will. And that's the part that is most destructive. Where is the will that we have as fellow Americans to make our country the country that we know it can be? Where is that will? So I would say to you that we need to see our elected officials doing a better job, but we need to elect officials that are doing a better, that can do a better job.
Yeah, I always seem to think that we're to blame since we get to vote. Someone asked about social media, and how do you see the media, social media opinion news changing to help facilitate things as opposed to the current situation where it seems to be tearing it down?
I promise you I did not pay somebody to ask that question, but I'm so happy that they did. The technology companies hate me, and they hate me because I have been very vocal about what I've seen. You've heard, I've read my bio. I have spent most of the time since 9/11 dealing with young people who find the ideology of terrorist organizations great. It's sobering. It is sobering to understand that a young person is being pushed in directions through the little device that they have on their phone, and that the American public that understands, this is not 10 years ago, I'm not looking at an audience that didn't know, 10 years ago you didn't know what the algorithms did, today you know what the algorithms do. You know that if you are looking for buying daisies at Home Depot, and you go online and you start looking at that, all you're gonna get is where to buy daisies for the next month. You know that. So imagine if you're a 13-year-old kid and you say, I don't belong. How can I belong? What happens if you're a 7-year-old boy who says, I like what Hitler said? The algorithms push you and push that kid in a particular direction. Our adversaries are not just nation states. Our adversaries are actors that want to take your grandkids and your kids and move them in a direction that allows them ideologically to be aligned. That isn't the only reason we have to look at what the technology companies are doing. What I would say is the social media platforms in the white world, in the world in which some of this stuff goes on, can be monitored and legislated by the people that you elect into office. It's not that hard. However, I also know that you as a parent or you as a grandparent understand that what happens in a home teaches a child how to behave. And the norms that you put in place matter. If you are letting your child be online and you have no idea what it is that they are doing, you're asking them to cross the street without looking both ways. And so digital literacy is part of this as well. So one piece is the legislation that we should demand happen with the technology companies in the red lines, in pushing hate and extremism, not to speak of the other vile stuff that they are pushing, okay? But in addition to that, There's a role and a responsibility you as a parent or a grandparent or auntie or uncle or cousin or what brother or sister plays in how you understand the internet. So digital literacy is critical. If you don't know enough, there are places to learn. And once you do learn, you've got to teach your children as well what's happening. So I feel, as you can hear, I feel very strongly about Section 230. I feel very strongly about how we have looked the other ways to all of these tech guys who come to Washington and lie in Congress and tell them one thing when in fact we know that there's another thing that's going on. And the final thing I'll say to you is, for those people who've been working on extremism, the NGOs that are working on extremism in our country and around the world, we have begged the tech companies to be more transparent about their data, and they refuse to do it. And there's a reason why they refuse to do it. Researchers cannot understand what's happening if they don't have the data. If the tech companies don't share the data, you're kind of flying blind. America is in a place where we can either say, well, it's not our problem, and let us see what happens in the next 25 years, or we can do what Europe did, which is not perfect, but they put norms in place to make sure that those tech companies have to pay a fine if they do not live by the standards that the European Union decided were good enough for their citizens, but we have decided are not needed for ours. For those people who have been watching the erosion of trust in our country and the polarization, we did not just turn a switch and it suddenly appeared. This has been going on for a while. And I personally would not put blame on one political party, one human being, one, you know, technology company. It's the combination effect of many things that have changed our nation, including, by the way, I never use the word civility in my speech, and I want to just use it right now. You know that there's a lack of civility in our country. Something has happened to us. I have no idea when that happened. Over the last couple of decades, I go back to 9/11 because I've been watching this stuff since 9/11, and I don't feel comfortable talking prior to 9/11 because I don't have the data. But for me, as I've looked at the rise of hate, the rise of us versus them, all of these things started to circulate at the same time that technology started to be built in a much bigger way. You will remember, by the way, on 9/11, there was no Facebook like madness in the world, or Instagram, or TikTok, or all this kind of stuff. All of these things were built, they were used more as the years went by. And the combination effect, George, for me, is a looking of the other way of the American public. Our leaders who have been elected from both parties not taking this issue seriously. Technology companies that are willing to make money on hate. I could go on and on, that have produced the environment with which it is perfectly normal now to say there are both sides to people holding tiki torches who are neo-Nazis in the University of Virginia.
Well, I think as a follow-up, a little bit to what you're saying now, someone wants to know about the role of religion in soft power. Does the Vatican have a role today? And Muslims and Christians are both people of the book. Yeah. You know, what's the role?
So the State Department, and I have to confess, I'm not sure what's happened to the Office of Faith at the State Department. It may still be there, I don't know. But under both Democrats and Republicans, we have seen over decades, it's not just recent history, over decades, obviously there's a religious, it's important to do religious outreach through the Vatican, through other entities, because we know that there's a way to communicate in a way. The Vatican, by the way, is its own, I don't want to put that in the same. The Vatican is its own entity. So we have an ambassador to the Vatican. It's just like another nation state in that way. And so if you're asking, if the question is, can we as the United States and have we as the United States interfaced on the faith dimension? Of course we have. Not just the Abrahamic faiths. We do it across the board. And we do it not because faith is the most important thing that we have to look at, but it's because it's part of the complexity of different communities around the world. So sometimes you have to have the ability to have conversations with faith leaders and get to know them and hear what they have to say.
And someone wants to know, our policies are based on our understanding of history. What will the U.S. revisiting efforts of history, redefining history in some cases, do to our future policies?
I'm so sorry. Could you just read that one more time? I'm not sure I understood.
Our policies are based on our understanding of history. What will the U.S. revisiting revisioning effort to history, revisioning history, do to the future?
I'm going to go back to what I said.
My
about
reading, not your understanding.
No, I just wasn't right. So there are two components to this question. One is who is reading history, and I have a whole thing I can tell you about the civics and history that has eroded in our classrooms, and you all know that because I'm seeing a lot of people shake their heads. But there's also this mis and disinformation that's happening, and that goes back to what I was saying about technology companies. The fact that we are allowing history to be taught to kids through TikTok, not allowing, I shouldn't say it like that. The norms have changed so that we are seeing far more inventions on what actually happened, both through video and in written form, that are telling a different tale. It is going to be very, very dangerous, because if we don't have facts, which goes to that's really the question about facts, what does it mean for the kids who are growing up who don't really understand what really happened? So I think there's one piece that's the foreign policy people who are not aware of the history. We've lost a lot of foreign service officers, people who have walked the walk, who can tell you, you know, I did this 20 years ago, or I did this 30 years ago, or wow, there's a file on this from whatever, and we can do this. That's all gone. So people are learning this all over again. I mean, I've talked to young people. I teach at Georgetown. I teach a small class in the spring, every spring, on countering violent extremism, and these kids weren't born on 9/11. And I play for them. I play for them in one of the first classes some clips from 9/11. Now, in their history classes in high school, they saw the towers coming down. They kind of vaguely understand this. But what I show them is Democrats and Republicans standing side by side at the Capitol, saying we are Americans. They can't believe it. They've never seen anything like that. They cannot understand. So the fact that we have footage of this, it's not manipulated footage. It is footage of our leaders that we elected who do not agree on a ton of things, but agree that we were attacked on 9/11 and we've got to come together as a country. It's inspiring to watch these kids suddenly understand, like, oh my gosh, we used to be like this. So I think facts, I mean, I try to bring in, like, I know you heard this and I know you might think that. We are seeing in wars that are happening right now a manipulation of videos and a lot of conspiracy theories and propaganda and all the things that you would do if you're trying to win people over, you're trying to get them emotionally involved. And we need to be really clear about what's taking place and the impact it's going to have on us long term. And that impact is going to be very, very severe. That is my answer to the question.
And you haven't talked about some specifics that maybe people want you to. Have the wars in Gaza and Ukraine had a real impact on our soft power, the perception of others, of us?
Yes, it has. They have. Each of the administrations, both the Biden and the Trump administrations, obviously have a different way of approaching the world. And so what you're seeing in data from the way people see us, I gave you some stats right now. I don't want to be political right now, so I'm simply going to say it has affected us, what our presidents have said and how they treat others and what we understand to be important to us, i.e. the invasion of another country by Russia into Ukraine with no provocation. Is a very important thing for us to be able to stand by. Our commitment to NATO is exceptionally important for us to be able to stand by. The tools that we are willing to give and the trainings that we need to be able to do military to military are really important. It matters. I mean, I'm talking now obviously about Russia and Ukraine. That has mattered really, really dramatically. The way countries are talking about us now in terms of our wobbling approach to the Russian-Ukraine relationship, what Russia has done to Ukraine, what our commitment is to NATO, all of that is being talked about right now. With regard to the Hamas attack on Israel and the aftermath, it's evolving right now. And I think you're seeing that in real time on the front pages of whatever paper you're reading. I think I'd make a broad statement, which is America has always been we have never been perfect, but we have been able to bring people together to talk about an approach and try to sort things out. I think America is in a different posture today. I think you're seeing Europeans looking at a change in the way America has behaved and saying to themselves, we cannot count on America, and we need to do things in a different way, and that is going to fundamentally change the balance in the world.
Then here's a positive question.
Thank you.
Once we are hopefully able to rebuild our soft power, are there aspects that you would change or focus on more than we did previously?
Oh, that's a great question. I love that question. We have to go much bigger on soft power in terms of the budgets, I said that, and in the innovation around soft power. One of the things I'm fascinated by is that the soft power toolkit is from the Cold War. We have not updated it. So you talk to anybody, even today, what is soft power? And today's, they're like, Netflix is soft power. Yes, it is. You know, it is, and it's a good tool. What we're pushing forward if we want to, but I think as diplomats, diplomatic soft power, I think we need to be thinking about what lessons have we learned about human behavior? What do we know about the human mind? How do we build trust in new ways? And I would want to have more money spent on research around that to find out, and this is really important, there are three generations that I really care about, sorry, and I'm not one of them. So one is Gen Alpha. Those are kids who are, let me start from the top, millennials, Gen Z, and Gen Alpha. I care about those three, and why do I care about them? Because they're the ones who can be the forerunners for the things that we know we want to build. So if we can go big on soft power, if we can help them, if we can understand what makes a 7-year-old tick versus a 31-year-old tick, if we understand what is attractive to them and we build a really unified strategy that has nuance in it, that understands the different generations and how they understand the world, we will be able to dominate in soft power around the world. And at this moment in time, I can tell you, I have not seen any other country in the world take that approach, an approach that says, we're taking the long-term view of what the world's going to be like in the next 25 years. And as a result of that, we're going to understand what these three generations like, what they dislike, what they're attracted to, what they're not attracted to. And we're going to build our ambitions based on the tools of the toolkit will depend on how to get to those particular audiences. We can't use tools from the 1970s for the kids who are here today. And we are doing that. So that's what I would say.
Well, thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Thanks very much. George, thank you.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's program featured a talk by foreign policy strategist and former diplomat Farah Pandith. This talk was recorded on August 11th, 2025 at the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. You can find the full program on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on Shows to find Speaking in Maine and many other on-demand programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Susan Tran is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and today's program was produced by me, Jane Donahue. Thanks for joining us. This is Maine Public Radio.